We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This is the day of the month we set aside to talk about money management, and we're happy to have again with us as guest David Sinha. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And on these programs once a month, always on a Friday, he stops by and talks a little bit about some economic subject, maybe something about the economy or something in particular that he'd like you to know a little bit about or more about. And then if you have questions on that or anything else that has to do with investing money management, you give us a call, you ask your question, and Dave will try and help you out. With that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you with us again.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I think it's instructive to spend, well, just a few brief moments discussing the 2010 stock market results and an important lesson reemphasized. First, we all know that stocks enjoyed a very substantial year, although stocks overall are approximately 20% lower than their all-time highs, and those all-time highs were back on October 9th of 2007. For example, the S&P 500, our benchmark, gained almost 13% for the year, and small company and mid-company stock indexes exceeded 20, even 25% for the year. For the most part, the U.S. stock market outperformed international stocks, with some exceptions in the emerging market sector. However, the big story, which investors really haven't focused on or have forgotten about, is the fact that as of early September, just last year, most U.S. and global stocks were actually negative for the year. And the big upward movement in the stock market really occurred in the last 3.5 months of 2010. The real lesson is that no one can accurately predict when these major stock market moves will take place. And if you want to participate in the stock market, you have to be willing to take the good with the bad, and you have to forget market timing and concentrate on asset allocation. So imagine when we heard all of that bad news abroad in August and early September about European countries on the verge of bankruptcy. You remember we talked about Portugal and Ireland and Spain, etc., that they were in terrible trouble. The stock market turned negative, and many, many stocks were negative. And then suddenly, there were bailout programs. Other countries came to the rescue. And lo and behold, that stock market just turned on a dime, basically, and moved up over those last 3.5 months. Now, last year, our couch potato portfolio outperformed the S&P 500 by approximately 3%. In other words, diversification really paid off in 2010. And of course, you can access our couch potato portfolio online at the WILL website. It was just updated through last night's close. Now, this is important. For the first time in several years, I have changed the asset allocation of our couch potato portfolio. And in particular, I have changed the percentage in two of the indexes in our portfolio. First, previously, we have the Vanguard Emerging Markets Index at approximately 5% of the portfolio. In other words, for every dollar we were going to put into the stock market, previously 5 cents of that dollar went into the specific emerging markets index. I've moved that from 5% back to 2.5%. And the reason I've done that is because we are also in another index called the Vanguard Total International Index. And interestingly enough, the Vanguard Total International Index has 25% of its money in emerging markets. So we actually became slightly overweighted in emerging markets. It worked out just fine over the last 12 to 18 months. That was okay. But we need to put our program back into balance and by essentially leaving the total international index alone, which has substantial exposure to emerging markets, and actually taking that emerging markets index and halving it, then we are back to a more reasonable asset allocation with respect to emerging markets. Now, what are we going to do with that 2.5%? Well, that 2.5% has been reallocated into Vanguard U.S. small cap value. The small caps outperformed the large caps last year. And historically, when markets make very, very large moves, typically small caps will outperform large caps, and the value sector then comes alive, and you get the most bang for your buck. So we have moved up small cap value from 10% of our portfolio to 12.5% of our portfolio, and these changes are already reflected on the WILO website, where we follow the couch potato portfolio. If you have questions about that, I'd be delighted to answer them for you. All right, let's change directions just for a moment and discuss retail inflation and the CPI, or Consumer Price Index. Now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics each month reports the Consumer Price Index, which is really one index, one way of looking at core inflation. It represents a substantial basket of goods and services. And interestingly enough, on an annualized basis, and really for quite some time, this core inflation reported rate has hovered in the 1 to 1.5% area. Now, how can that possibly be when we know that gasoline prices are surging, commodity and food prices, both at the wholesale and retail level, are surging, medical expenses are up? Well, interestingly enough, the CPI, which is so generally quoted, is very heavily weighted toward housing, which includes home ownership, which includes renting, and then secondarily, interest rates. As a result, the index really doesn't necessarily represent how inflation impacts you and I, certainly at the individual level. Now, the January 3rd Wall Street Journal edition included a wonderful table on the changes of various goods and services over the past 3 years. And I love this table because it really more accurately reflects how inflation has impacted you and I. Now, for example, single-family homes over the last 3 years have actually decreased nationally some 13%. The median resale price just 3 years ago was about $198,000. Today, about $172,500. Unleaded gasoline, interestingly enough, on average in 2008, was $3.26. That's a bit surprising, but you remember there was that big run-up in 2008, then a run down to about $2, $2.50 in 2009, and of course it is now run back up. But as of the end of 2010, gasoline prices over the last 3 years had actually decreased 13%. And when we factored those two items into the CPI, that's the primary reason that the CPI had only moved up about 1 to 1.5%. Now, a pair of those fancy stonewashed jeans at the Gap, I'm not even sure what those are, but apparently they cost $44 back in 2008. And by the end of 2010, they averaged $54. That was an increase of 22%. Internet services have increased some 5% over the last 3 years. Hospital stays, a one-day hospital stay in 2008, about $5,300. Today, $7,500, an increase of some 41%. How about a McDonald's Big Mac hamburger? Oh, boy, $3 a couple years ago, $3.20 today, about an 8% increase. A movie ticket. Well, we do go to the movies. Used to be about $7 some 3 years ago. Today, it's pushing $8, about a 9% increase. Even the cost of getting born, apparently, is getting a lot more expensive. The average hospital cost for mother and child, excluding private physician's fees, averaged in 2008 about $9,000. Today, it's closing in on $11,000, almost a 20% increase. A year in college, 2008, 21,000. Today, pushing close to 24,000, a 12% increase. And David, finally, I guess the cost of dying has even gone up. It's gone up 4 to 5% over the last 3 years, according to the American Funeral Directors Prices and Association. So you see that a variety of different items impact us all differently. But overall, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, our government CPI indicator, because it is so heavily weighted in interest rates and the cost of housing, it appears that retail inflation has averaged about 1%. Obviously, inflation affects all of us quite differently. So there you have it, David, a little bit about the stock market, a little bit about inflation. Be delighted to visit about these particular factors, other things that are on our listeners' minds. There's just a whole host of things we could talk about. Income tax change, estate taxes, etc., new IRA rules, you name it, they're out there.
All right. Questions are welcome. Phone lines are open, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here and we do these shows. I have an email here, a question here, and it seems fairly straightforward, so let me ask you. The person here writes, we have SERS pensions, State University Retirement System pensions, which are not taxed in the state of Illinois. If you live in Illinois,
you don't
pay tax. The writer says, we're thinking about purchasing a vacation home in California or Arizona, and those states tax pensions. If we do this, will it open us up to having our pensions taxed by those states if we keep our primary home in Illinois?
That's a great question, and this is an issue of domicile. If your primary residence remains in Illinois, you vote in Illinois, you have an Illinois driver's license, you have an affidavit of domicile that says that I am an Illinois domiciliary, then you are subject to state income tax in Illinois. And if Illinois, at least currently, doesn't tax those SERS pensions, they don't even tax IRA distributions at the moment, so you are safe if you have a summer home in California. Now, be careful. If you make some money on that summer home and you sell that summer home in California, that's a California piece of real estate, and that gain would be subject to income tax in the state of California. So if you have assets in California or some other state, you sell those assets, primarily real estate, you may be subject to income tax if that particular state does have income tax to begin with. Okay. If you're in Texas, if you're in Nevada, for example, Alaska, well, you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, so that's might be one of the things. If you're actually thinking about you're retiring and you're actually thinking about permanently leaving the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Other states, I don't know how many.
But you've got Florida.
Many other
Florida's
states.
The big one.
They do tax your Illinois
absolutely.
Pension benefit. So,
absolutely.
You know, you might want to put that in your mix if you're deciding to, you know, you want to retire to Florida or Arizona or California.
Yeah. Wherever. Absolutely. All absolutely. Right. There's no question. So all that's right. Why a lot of New Yorkers, for example, have retired to Florida because Florida doesn't have a state income tax.
Okay. Well, let's see. We have somebody here on the phone. We have a caller in Champaign. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Good morning, David and David.
Mm-hmm.
Since the first caller, the email was about pensions, I was wondering if you could comment on the prospects for SERS in the long run being for me the next 10 to 20 years, and particularly the story in the New York Times this morning about pressures in Congress to allow states to do to their pensioners what some corporations have, declare bankruptcy to get out of pension obligations.
Those are great questions, and no one knows the complete answers. I have substantial confidence in the SERS program. And I would be almost awestruck if the state of Illinois or many other states actually declared bankruptcy. I think there are some changes that are going to come down the road, however. If I was a betting person, which I'm not, I believe ultimately all of these pensions, whether they are SERS pensions, IRA pensions, etc., are going to be subject to state income tax. And that, if you actually did the numbers, based upon the people who are taking money out of teachers' retirement, SERS, the various retirement programs, IRA, traditional IRA distributions, that's a lot of money. That's in the hundreds of millions of dollars that are not being collected by the state of Illinois. So I see that as a change coming. I also think that ultimately there is going to be a change on the COLA provision, this 3% increase which pensioners actually receive each year. I think that is going to change. That may end up as a constitutional battle, but I believe that ultimately that is going to change. Here's the good news. The good news is that, at least with respect to SERS, it is extraordinarily well managed. There are great money managers running those assets, a great board overlooking the program, great administrators, and we've had some recovery in the stock market, which brings the funding levels up a bit. So all of those things are helpful. So my view is certainly over the next 10 years, I think that the SERS pensioners who are receiving their pensions today really don't have a whole lot to worry about, and probably not even over the next 20 years. But I do think there may be some changes in the increases that one can look forward to each year, this 3% business, and then the taxability. So the first step was the 2% increase in state of Illinois taxes, and I think we're going to see some more increases that are going to impact our pensions. But essentially, I think essentially that your pension is safe.
I suppose one of the reasons I'm asking is that I'm, you know, in my late 60s and trying to decide if or when to retire.
Along with a lot of us.
Yeah. And that also, you know, one of the related issues there is survivor's benefits. If you die in harness versus if you're retired. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that. And I'll get off the line and listen to the rest offline.
All right. Thanks for the
call.
Thank
you very much.
Well, there are some differences. If you pass away while you are still working, then there are some different impacts for your spouse. In other words, you receive a lump sum plus a smaller annuity. But that impacts people differently depending on whether they're in the money purchase side or whether they're just on the 2.2% formula. So I really am not qualified off the top of my head to give you a lot of information about that. But for people who are contemplating that, you raise a very, very good issue, and certainly one could make an appointment with SERS to discuss that matter, and I would feel more comfortable about that,
yeah,
doing that.
You know, the folks there are very nice. I'm sure they would be very happy to visit you and discuss how much you would retire, how much you would receive when you retire, at certain points when you retire, would help you try to figure out what would be to your best.
Right. And indeed, SERS encourages you substantially before you are even contemplating retirement, yeah, to make an appointment with your SERS representative. So I would encourage all of you who are considering that. They're not going to give you answers about, gee, the financial integrity of SERS, how long it's going to last, what's going to make those changes. Remember, they are administrating the program as is, and they are very, very knowledgeable people, extremely knowledgeable. And it's fortunate that it's located, really, the headquarters in Champaign. They're just great people, and it really has been a great program.
Right. Another caller here. We'll go next to Glenview, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good morning, Dr. Sino.
Good morning.
I had a question for you. Could you tell me what your thoughts are about dividend income funds as a short, medium, and long-term investment, and perhaps you might have a recommendation?
Well, lots of people are searching for yield. When they look at money market funds that are paying a tenth, two-tenths, three-tenths of a percent, a six-month CD that is paying three, four-tenths of a percent, a 1 or 2 year CD that is under 1%, obviously people are concerned about yield. So many, many people are turning to dividend-paying stocks. Historically, these have been utility stocks. They have often been drug stocks, etc. And they're looking at the yields on many of these stocks, and they're saying, wait a second, The dividend yield on these stocks are 2 to 5%. Perhaps I would be better off actually owning a stock and earning somewhere between a 2 and 5% dividend. Well, obviously, there's some questions there. Are the dividends going to continue? And are the stocks going to increase or decrease in value? Because one must always look at total return as opposed to just what the dividend return is on an individual stock. But it certainly is one cogent, one intelligent, one reasonable strategy that you could pursue. And there are any number of mutual fund companies, including Fidelity, including Vanguard. In fact, most of the very large family of funds has a dividend-based mutual fund, and they're easy to access, and they're not all particularly different. What I would look at is the overall expense ratio of those funds, and it would not be unreasonable to dollar cost average into one of those funds if you are searching out higher dividends. Some people will look at stocks themselves, and they will look often at phone companies, cable companies, energy companies, because these historically have paid very, very substantial dividends. And they will put together a diversified portfolio and hope that those stocks either continue to increase or maintain their value. And often that type of portfolio will throw off 3, 4, maybe even 5%. There is just a plethora of information available on the net on dividend paying stocks, but understand that they are stocks, and stocks go up and stocks go down. But if you are interested in a dividend, it certainly is a reasonable strategy. So I would not be adverse to having 10% of your portfolio in that type of strategy. So it's a great question and certainly a great strategy to pursue.
May I also ask, Doctor, if this in any way is an alternate to an annuity?
Well, it may or may not be. There are so many different kinds of annuities that are out there currently. One of the best strategies that is available today are really gift annuities, where you are taking a portion of your money, making a charitable gift to a charity of your choice, for example, the University of Illinois. And then, based upon your age or the joint age of you and your spouse, that company, that charitable organization, pays you back at a fixed rate and for the rest of your joint lives. And you will find that that rate is significantly higher than you could earn just in a certificate of deposit, in dividend-paying stocks, maybe even in an insurance annuity. The difference, of course, is that when you are being paid the sum of money back each year, maybe 5%, maybe 6%, and this is for your joint lives, the difference is that a portion of the money that you're receiving back, of course, is the principal that you donated in the first place. And then the charity ultimately ends up with whatever is left over after the second death. But this is an enormously powerful and popular strategy, because when you donate money and donate by essentially making this charitable gift annuity, you get an initial tax break, because a portion of that you don't get back, and that portion, based upon your age and IRS annuity tables, will tell you exactly how much of this is tax deductible. So you have to be very, very careful about these annuities. You really need to talk to your financial advisor to see, one, if it's appropriate, and two, what kind of annuity then makes the most sense.
Well, thank you very much for that, Doctor. That's really appreciated.
All right. Yes. Thank you for the call. We're at our midpoint of this hour of Focus. It's our monthly show on personal finance. David Sino is our guest. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at U of I. And if you have questions about your particular financial situation, give us a call and He'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
My question concerns mutual bonds. I understand that 100 municipalities in this country are on the verge of bankruptcy. And should I be concerned about my mutual bond investments?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you own individual municipal bonds, or are you in a mutual fund that holds municipal bonds?
I'm in a fund.
All right. Well, if you are in a substantially diversified fund, what you want to look at is the quality of the bonds that are being held. If most of those bonds are what are called general obligation bonds, I wouldn't be very concerned. General obligation bonds are backed by the full faith and taxing authority of the issuer. So I would want to be in a very, very high quality municipal bond fund. Secondly, I don't think I would want to be in a bond fund where the average maturity of that bond fund is a great, great long time in the future. I'm much happier with a shorter time horizon, especially with the volatility in the municipal bond market. So I'd be looking for funds that are high quality and also fairly short duration, maybe 3 to 7, maybe 3 to 10 years in terms of duration and maturity of those bonds. But again, that's something that you could visit with your advisor to see if that is an appropriate fund. What most people don't realize is that any bond fund, whether it's a municipal bond fund, a treasury bond fund, a corporate bond fund, is subject to what is called interest rate risk. What that means is that when interest rates move up, the value of bonds go down. There is an inverse relationship between the direction of interest rates and the valuation of the bond itself. And because in a mutual fund you own shares, and those shares reflect the price of those bonds, if you believed, for example, that interest rates were going to increase substantially or even moderately, then it is more likely than not that the value of your shares will actually go down. So when we look at a mutual fund that holds bonds, we have to be very, very careful to examine total return. That is, what's the value of my shares on day one? What's the value of my shares on day 31? And what did I earn during that period of time to really look at total return? So there's a lot involved in owning bond funds. Now, bond funds have dropped in share value over the last 3 months. A number of bond funds really have not only lost value, but substantial amounts of money by investors have been taken out of these bond funds. On the other hand, if you feel that interest rates aren't going to move a whole lot, and I happen to feel that way, I don't see any tremendous increase in this country in jobs. I haven't seen that yet. Then I think the Federal Reserve has to continue to do all they can to keep interest rates rather low in order to spur the economy. And as long as interest rates aren't moving very much, then the value of these bond funds shouldn't drop precipitously from where they have dropped during the last 3 months. Does that help at all?
The caller has rung off, so okay. I hope that indeed it did help. I have an email question here, and it says from someone who, I'll just read the question. And it concerns the fact that a major local employer, I think I will not name them, let's just say it is a very large healthcare institution that employs a lot of people here locally. Okay. So this major local employer is moving its 401k plan from Fidelity to a local bank's wealth management division, and apparently they're moving to the local bank and also to Charles Schwab, says the listener. So here are the questions. Can you address any concerns an employee should have questions that should be asked, pitfalls to avoid in the process. And they also wonder, is this the opposite of dollar cost averaging, and does it therefore entail some risk of loss?
Well, it's a bit difficult for me to answer those questions without really understanding and knowing about the nature of the new program. Obviously, if we are moving from Fidelity to Schwab, that's a custodian-to-custodian change, and that is a tax-deferred transaction. So there won't be any tax taking place as that change takes place. Now, one of the questions you might ask is, all right, if I'm at Fidelity and I'm happy with my Fidelity funds and I'm moving to Schwab as custodian, Schwab can hold Fidelity funds, right, as custodian. So the question is, can I still hold the same funds? I don't know the answer to that because I don't know what the plan provisions say. And there may be a fee charged either by Schwab or the advisor if you want to hold those continued funds. A second question is, okay, what's happening if I can't hold those same Fidelity funds? Am I going to be transferred into different funds? Or is that a decision that I am going to make? Three, I think you want to know whether or not you can establish at Schwab a self-directed account. In other words, if you're going to move all of my money to Schwab, and I'm going to now have Schwab as my custodian, do I have the choice of accessing carte blanche all of the different funds or all of the different investment opportunities that Schwab offers? And four, if I don't want to do any of those things, what are the different asset allocation models or choices I have at my local bank with my local wealth manager at the bank? I think those are all reasonable questions to ask. I am not privy to any inside information about those, but those are four what I would call acid questions mm-hmm. that I would want to have answered.
And it sounds like the assumption, my assumption reading what the person had to say here, is that the money would be moved in one big chunk.
Absolutely.
They'd push a button and that it would all go from one place to the other place all at once.
Well, that's the hope, and it'll all arrive there eventually, yeah. Yes. So one of the questions is, do I have to liquidate at Fidelity, for example, and just move cash to Schwab, or can I move my actual positions at Fidelity to Schwab? That's sort of a real major question.
All right. Well, we hope that helps. We will continue. We'll talk next with someone in Georgetown. This is line one. Hello.
Well, good morning. It's only Karen here calling.
Karen, how are you?
My usual bond question here. I know it's when you give your asset allocation that, I mean, not only you, but many people, when they give an asset, they only list like stocks. How about the percentage in bond funds that we should have?
Well, again, the couch potato portfolio is specifically for stocks, as you know. And I always point out, look, that's the stock part of your portfolio.
Right.
It certainly is not your fixed income portion. And that varies depending upon risk. But I feel pretty strongly that regardless of age, until we're really up in our 80s or 90s, I feel very, very comfortable with a diversified portfolio of stocks of at least 35% of your overall positions. So that would leave, if you were in a 35% stock market investor, I guess that would leave what, 65% for fixed income, real estate, et cetera, alternative investments.
Well, I'm talking about just strictly bond funds.
Well, strictly bond funds as opposed to CDs, as opposed to cash, et cetera.
Yes.
Well, it depends. Again, it depends on the individual investor. I don't have a great answer for you with respect to that because I look at bond funds as part of my fixed income allocation. And I'm not trying to play games here. I'm simply saying that at some points in time, I'm more comfortable with CDs. Sometimes I'm more comfortable with municipal bonds. Sometimes I'm more comfortable with bond funds. But if I'm going to be in bond funds, let's be real clear about this, that ultimately interest rates are going to head north. And if that is the case, whether it's 6 months from now or 6 years from now, The bottom line is I don't want to be strung out in 30-year bond funds. I want to have short and intermediate-term bond funds. And whether I put 30% of my money in there or 40 or 50% of my money in there, I don't want to be in long-term bond funds. I continue to believe that that is a mistake. And the people who should be in long-term bond funds are insurance companies and some banks who are really practicing asset liability management.
And by long-term, you mean long-term in, as far as durations go?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'm still back into this 3 to 7 year sort of fit that I still believe provides you with the most value.
Well, that would also include, say, the Vanguard funds.
Short and intermediate, connected. Yes.
Total bond fund, things of that nature.
Right. Total bond is a little bit longer, but short and intermediate, the short term, the corporate bond fund, the short corporate bond fund, I think those are all reasonable places to have your money. I don't have any problem with any of those.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Another caller here in Norridge, Illinois, on our toll-free line. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to know if there's an ETF that could be recommended that would have to do with the agricultural products.
You stumped me. I'd have to go back and do some research. Maybe another caller can call in and talk about an ETF that deals specifically with agricultural products, agricultural companies, etc. I'm sure it's out there.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing it's out there. Maybe you can Google agricultural ETF and find out for yourself, but I'm not specifically aware of one. But I will report back on that on the next show. It's a great question.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions, again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can email will-talk@illinois.edu, and we have about 10 minutes left in the program.
You know, David, there have been a number of tax changes, and also some of the tax changes didn't happen that everyone thought would occur. But I want to talk specifically about IRAs. Here's something that is interesting in 2011 that has been reinstituted. People may have forgotten about this. For people who are required to take their minimum distribution, that means they've reached the golden age of 70 and a half. When they take their minimum distribution, they could just take it and pay income tax on it. Alternatively, they can have that money directly sent to charities of their choice. And by doing that, they would not be taxed on that money. This works very well for people who don't itemize and who are required to take IRA distributions, because then they can essentially take some of that money and designate it specifically so the check, instead of going to them, goes directly to the charity. Now, you have to be careful. It has to be a 501c3 organization, so it would have to be something like a church, synagogue, U of I Foundation, national charity, etc., United Way, you name it. That works. It cannot be a donor-advised fund. It can't be a charitable gift annuity. It has to be money directly and outright to a charity. So this represents a planning opportunity for people who are required to take a minimum distribution in 2011 and do not itemize.
Very well. Urbana, another caller here, line 1. Hello.
Hi. Interested in what sort of allocation one should have if one is, say, 90 years old.
90 years old and going strong, I hope.
Yeah, that's not myself, but I have family that I'd like to know how to advise them.
Okay, and one of the questions I have is with respect to the family, are they, in terms of net worth, everything is taken care of? Do they have a positive or negative cash flow?
Positive.
So they have a positive cash flow. Mm-hmm. So really what we're talking about is assets that are likely to be inherited for the next generation. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I think so. But you never know when, how long somebody will be really seriously ill and need nursing home care, this kind of thing.
That kind of thing. Okay. If someone has a positive cash flow based upon Social Security, pension benefits, etc., I really do not have a problem with at least a minimum of 20% allocated to stocks. Don't have a problem at all. So do you know the current asset allocation?
No, I don't. But she has an advisor, but he's with a stock company. You know, it's not a fee-only advisor. He's got an interest in...
Okay, a broker.
Yeah.
A broker.
Right, that's the word I want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a whole different situation. That's an entirely different situation. And keep in mind, there are some great stock brokers out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are some. There's some that aren't so great, but there are some great stock brokers. But I'm back to looking at an overall asset allocation. And again, that's because I believe at any age, people should have some exposure to the extent they have assets that enable them to do so. They should have some exposure to the equity markets, if not for themselves, but for the next generation. So 20% would not be unreasonable.
And if they have a negative cash flow, in other words, they're... Well, if they have a negative cash flow.
Well, if they have a negative cash flow, they're really between a rock and a hard place because they can't risk further diminution of principal. But on the other hand, because they can't invest in stocks or equities, which is a hedge against inflation, typically people will run out of money then before they run out of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very, very difficult place to be in. And the minute those kinds of people go into the stock market, gee, if they run into the freight train of 2008, then it's really problematic.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Right, thank you for the call. And we go again to another caller, and this is someone in Clinton. Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello there. I just turned on the radio, so I don't know what you've discussed, but I hope it's not something you've already discussed. I'm calling about taxes.
Okay.
Looking at the forms here, and they are saying that the first time home buyers that bought a home in 2008 and got that 8,000 credit.
Okay.
Which we thought that was just a given, and now they're saying this has to be paid back over 15 years. Is that correct?
Well, you've stumped me. You've stumped me. There were two different programs that took place over the last 3 or 4 years, and I just can't recall off the top of my head. One of them was that if you were a first-time home buyer, that you actually received a credit against taxes. That was
right.
The second program, and there was no payback for that. The other program was a program that essentially provided you with money, and you did have to pay that back over a 15-year period. Now, were you involved in the first program or the second program?
Well, it was in 2008, probably the middle of the year. Well, it's actually my son who did it, but I do his taxes. And he had already done his taxes, so we made an amended form. And, of course, you know, they had paid in a lot of taxes. Amended form, and he did get back that $8,000. But there was nothing ever said through all of this about having to pay anything back. And as I understand it, the people that got into that program in 2009, they don't have to pay.
Correct.
Back.
That's absolutely correct.
That's not
absolutely
right.
I'm not arguing with you, but they were two different programs to stimulate housing. And
right.
It sounds as though if your son was in the first program, that was the program where you had to pay the money back. As a matter of fact, I recall looking at that program for one of my daughters, and we decided not to take advantage of it because it was a 15-year payback. Now, admittedly, you pay it back with no interest.
Right.
So you're getting the benefit, essentially, of an interest-free loan. But again, at these interest rates, that's not very large. So I am guessing if he was in the first program, he does have to pay it back. But I would caution you, and I would suggest that you strongly talk to a tax advisor.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, on the books that I got from the IRS, it says, like, what's new for this year?
Yes.
And this was one of the things that was on that list. Now, the way we understood it when it got it said you had to keep the house for 3 years if you know, it wasn't your main house. Or if you sold it, then you had to pay it back. But we did not know this.
Right.
He is going to be shocked.
All right. Well, good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sorry, we can't give you better news than that. Let's continue here. We have a caller in Bloomington, Illinois, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Excuse me. The last late summer or fall, you suggested that after the first of the year might be a good time to buy treasuries. And the last time, well, I checked, and in December, they weren't any better. They're still in, I think, one something for a 3-year note. So I wonder if you have any other predictions on these treasuries. Any other thoughts about that?
Well, I think when I was talking in the fall, I thought that interest rates would trend up, which they did, and it depressed the price of treasuries in treasury bond funds. So uh-huh. I was suggesting that if you were thinking of buying a treasury bond fund, that probably was not an appropriate time to buy it because the value of your bond fund would go down as interest rates moved up.
I buy notes.
So you're buying treasury notes. Well,
Treasury Direct, yeah.
Okay. So have you been doing that for some time?
Yes, many years, but not this last year. I've let a lot of them mature.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. And you probably are best served by maintaining your bond ladder, where you're sort of doing a bond ladder, where you would buy a treasury every year, or when a treasury matured, you bought another one, and you went out the same length of time.
I'm not buying any. Yeah, I do that, but I don't have any bonds, just notes.
Or treasury notes.
And, you know, some of the bank CDs are doing better than the treasury notes.
Well, that's why it makes more sense to shop and simply put your money where it is best served. So before I would buy a treasury note, you took the words right out of my mouth. It's very, very interesting to see the differences between the banks in what they are paying. And that is strictly a function of loan demand at the banks. If some banks have very, very substantial loan demand, they will increase their interest rates to buy deposits to fund those loans.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, do you have any predictions for the notes and bonds, treasuries?
Well, I think over the next several months, I don't see a lot of movement in the yields on treasury notes and bonds, because I think the Federal Reserve is going to continue to depress interest rates to the extent possible. As I've said, I have not seen enough pickup in economic activity, and I don't think the Fed has either, to allow and enable interest rates to move higher. So you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, like everyone else who's sitting on checking money and cash trying to figure out what to do with it.
I've been pretty happy with the Ginnie Mae's.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even the Ginnie Mae bond funds have held up very well.
Yes, that's what I have, and I was thinking of putting more into that.
Well, if you were, then what I would do is dollar cost average into that position. I would not take all of my money at once and do that, but certainly if you have a certain amount of money, if you did that over the next 12 months, that would be okay. 1/12th a month.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you, because I probably would have dumped it all in there.
No, don't do that. Don't do that.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I really appreciate your program each month.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're down here. We have a couple of minutes left. Actually, just it's something that I was thinking about earlier when you're talking about the couch potato fund, and you were talking about the fact that you know, some of the money goes into small caps and mid. And to me, now, simply when you talk about market capitalization, it's just a way of dividing companies up according to their size.
Absolutely.
Sort of mid-sized ones, smaller ones, and again, there are even things called micro caps.
Nano caps.
So, but the thing that I was just wondering was, well, okay, say we talk about small and mid cap. Well, exactly how big a company are we talking about?
Yeah,
and
what
can
does that
you
really
maybe
mean?
Like name
really
a couple things
what
that
does
are,
that mean?
You know, yeah,
well,
what does that
when
mean?
We talk about the S&P 500, we're talking about the 500 companies that have the largest market capitalization. And market capitalization is nothing more than how many shares are outstanding from a company, and we multiply it times the last known price. So when we think of a big company, and the biggest companies are like Exxon. So we're talking a company that has a market cap and that moves a lot. It could be essentially a $50 billion market cap or more. And that would be an example of a large company. In fact, the average cap of the S&P 500, I've forgotten, I think it's about 20 billion. A small cap, 2 billion, 2.5 billion, maybe one-tenth the size of a large company. Okay. The tiny, tiny companies, another one-tenth the size of the small cap companies. So there is an enormous difference between market capitalization between a very, very large company and a small cap company.
Let me. I have an email question here. I want to try and get in. I hope that there's enough time. Someone writes, what can one do to fix an ill-advised investment in a municipal bond for a small town in Illinois that will not mature until 2020? When I once tried to sell it through my financial institution, the only purchase offer was for 20% less than the initial value.
And you've just learned a hard lesson that when you buy a very, very small issue, you have a liquidity issue. There aren't any buyers. And to get someone to step up to the plate and buy, you're going to have to take a substantial haircut. So 20% would not be unreasonable to move out of that position. So that's all I can tell the potential seller.
All right. Well, Ed, with that, I think we're going to have to finish up. Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks this time around?
No, lots and lots of great questions. I want to come back to see if I can find an agricultural ETF. I'm going to go back and re-examine those two tax rules about housing. I felt bad that I didn't have dispositive answers for those two listeners. So it just tells you that our listening audience is extraordinarily sophisticated. That's what it tells, and it's lots of fun to tackle these questions.
Well, actually, I did. We got someone writing in that about mentioning a couple agriculture ETFs.
Great.
So I tell you what, why don't I'll just pass this on to you. You can take a look at it, and maybe we talk about it some more next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you very
much. David Sinnoh is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, once a month, always on a Friday. He is here on the show. We talk about personal finance.